I mean, it's fun to watch sci-fi, but this is not reality. Back to you, Roy.
I would agree with you, Paul. The problem is that you can't ultimately prove a negative. You can only prove a positive. I give you that ancient four-footed fish that everyone had thought had long since kind of disappeared as a living organism, and that they found a week or two ago and took a lot of pictures. So you can't prove that UFOs don't exist. The problem is every time you can prove that whatever people think are a UFO aren't a UFO. So that's what keeps on happening. People are really fascinated by aliens visiting us, either for good or for bad. The way that I look upon it, I'm not really cynical about life in the universe. I think it happens on a lot of planets. There are trillions of planets in the universe, so the law of averages are that life as we know it, and maybe life as we don't know it, exists all over the place, but it's probably scattered, and most of it is not sentient. You know, we're the only sentient animal on this planet, as far as I'm aware, and we've only been around for a pittance of the lifespan of this planet. So, and who knows how long we're going to stick around before we blow ourselves up or infect ourselves. So I think it's more a function that we're too spread out, and it's really a pain in the backside to travel long distances, and it takes a long time unless someone discovers faster-than-light traveling. So I do think there is life in the universe other than ours. I just don't think they buzz us and stop to take blurry pictures.
I can comment with you on that, Roy. Very, very true. There's a good book by Carl Sagan, The Candle in the Dark, and I think I've talked about it on this net years ago. And there's one chapter. It's called "I Have a Dragon in My Garage," and this, you know, this is where we're talking about pushing the goalposts back further and further, and then one guy's telling somebody that he has a dragon, fire-breathing dragon in his garage, and the other guy says, "Well, you know, I open the door." They open the door, and he says, "There's nothing there." Well, he's invisible. He's an invisible dragon. And then he says, "Well, if he's fire-breathing, I'll bring in some heat sensors." They go, "Oh, it's fire, but it doesn't give any heat." And one thing after the other, you know, how come I, one guy says one thing and the other guy says the other, and it just goes back and forth. And it's a very good chapter. And that's what happens with all these the people that are reporting UFOs. You know, you question them on this, and they just, you know, you're not gonna change their mind. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, there goes that noise in the background again. Yeah, Paul. The way it seems to me is there's a couple of grifters trying to make a buck, and a bunch of other people who, God love them, are very enthusiastic. They kind of did a great simulation of that in some movie about Mars Attacks, I think it was, where people just go out there and banners saying, "We love you, aliens. We can't wait to meet you." And the response was the Martians just burn them up with a death ray. So I don't know. They mean well. I don't think they don't, except for a couple of grifters who are obviously just in it for money. But there's something about humanity. Before we had aliens, we had ghosts. Before we had ghosts, we had angels. Before we had angels, we had demons. We always seem to want to put something out there and give it human-like qualities. And so this age is just the alien age. But we keep doing the same thing, really.
Very good, Roy. All right, I'll turn it back to you. Anyway, Mars Attacks, that's the name of that movie. Actually, a very funny movie. Back to you. going to build a Dyson sphere and have the Zeta Reticulans pay for it.
You know, people have almost gotten tired of the Dyson sphere, so now they have the O'Neill cylinder.
And what's that like?
Instead of a sphere encasing the sun, it's a rotating cylinder that can be extended an almost infinite number of miles on either end to increase the volume inside. And it has two levels of rotation, a slow level on the outside and a much higher level on the inside, so that centrifugal force produces fake gravitational forces in the inner cylinder. It's fascinating. O'Neill wrote about it in the 1980s in one of his books, and I recently read a great science fiction book where he basically travels to an alien environment and finds an O'Neill cylinder, and his job is to sneak into it and retrieve a friend who got imprisoned in there.
I hate when that happens. All right, anyway, 2H.
Yeah, just in general out there, if you like to read and you like to read science fiction and you like to read somewhat humorous with hard science, there's no dragons, there's no magic spells, look up this series of books called The Babaverse. It's a fascinating, charming, humorously tongue-in-cheek written story of a guy who buys into the cryogenic program to have his head frozen once he dies, and he does die, but rather than build a body, they simply use his brain to produce an artificial intelligence that seeds the galaxy with copies of himself, and he has to deal with the human race, and so the Babaverse. So take a look if you're interested in science fiction.
Could you spell that right?
Well, the series is the Babaverse, B-O-B-I-V-E-R. S-E. If you give me 1 second, I will Google it or Amazon it and give you far better information.
Thank you. I enjoy both humor and hard science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, this is wonderful. You don't have any diversity nonsense. You don't have any magic dragon nonsense. It's kind of like almost reading Asimov. It's delightful. The guy obviously does a lot of research because either he is an engineer or he's friendly with a bunch of engineers. The author's name is Dennis E. Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and he has a series of books, but the one that really I love is the Babaverse series. He has now 4 books in the series, and they're all charming and amusing, and I'm reading them for a second time, actually.
I know. Now, my guy for hard science fiction, and humor is, Andy Weir, the guy who wrote The Martian and Artemis, and I think he's just come out with something new.
Yes, he's very good. He also apparently talks to a lot of engineers. His is hard science. I tend to prefer, I don't really like magic. Some of them are done well. Lord of the Rings is a favorite of mine, despite the fact that it's magic. I like Asimovian hard science, where you could sort of tell that he had this clever idea of how to make things happen in an alternative universe, and he just went with it. There's all kinds of... I still love to read old Asimov books. But, yeah, Andy Weir is very good as well. It's very difficult to find hard science fiction these days. I don't think it's as popular with other people as it is with us.
That is very possible. Yes, I'm an Asimov fan. In my mind, I guess I separate the two things, the stuff with dragons and magic and incantations and stuff like that, in science fantasy. The stuff with some real stuff thrown in with the hard science and science fiction. But that is my method of classification. KC2GS, WB2KW3.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole spectrum. I mean, you know, the question is, where do you place Star Wars? Star Wars, to me, is what I would call soft science, where it could easily just be magic, although there's that great quote that any technology that's too sophisticated for us to understand ultimately can be called magic. But I'm not a big fan of Star Wars soft science. Because nothing really makes any particular sense. You get the sense that they're kind of making it up as they go along. You know, entertaining, yeah, but not very thought-provoking to me. Yes, Wesley.
We should consider the question how far behind Americans the rover device that landed on Mars is. Patricia.
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. How far it is? Or how far behind it is? And so the question would be, far behind what?
We have a Chinese rover that landed on the surface of the Mars. Then we have an American one that is there now. In terms of technology, how much Chinese are behind? And do you find it funny? Because it is a science, and it is a fun.
Well, not quite the same as sci-fi, but they're behind us. I would assume even they would admit to that. But they're very aggressive and they're driven, and it doesn't mean that they'll always be behind us. AMD was behind Intel for many, many, many years until all of a sudden Intel woke up and AMD basically had most of the market. So, you know, you never know what the future may lead to. They may jump ahead. I still kind of get the idea that, for the most part, Chinese science is more imitation and acquiring foreign intellectual property. They don't really have an individual mindset. They kind of work better together, and they tend to be better at doing things that have been done before. So I wouldn't be terribly optimistic about their short-term improvements, but they certainly are well-motivated, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, Paul will probably have a great deal more to say upon that than I can.
Later.
Okay, I just want to drop the carrier for a little while because I haven't heard from Frank lately. That's probably because we're all keying way too fast for Echo Link. So I'm going to let it drop, and please, everyone else, let it drop for a little while. Give Frank the opportunity if he wants to say anything more on the subject.
How funny is to know the number of engineers in China is bigger than the entire population of the United States.
Well, you know, I mean, what can I tell you? It's not the quantity, it's quality. You know, although they have a lot more people. Population is very, very big. India has 1.3 billion, which is one of the many reasons, unfortunately, that they're suffering as badly as they are from COVID-19. So it's not quantity that ultimately counts. It's quality.
Let me be for a moment devil's advocate. 72 or 73% of all of the students in universities are Asians. Does it say something to you?
Well, among other things, they have a very strong family system. The family system basically hyper motivates them for accomplishing things. Japanese students have a very high suicide rate because their parents drive them pretty much crazy to accomplish what they have to accomplish. And so, yeah, I'm not going to make any kind of racially based comment about Asian people being smarter than European people or any other type of people. But they do have a strong ethic in learning, and they have apparently to a degree, at least outside of mainland China, less of a motivation of purely making money. Because if you got brains and you want to make money, probably you want to go into the stock market or investment banking or entrepreneur type of things. Science and engineering will give you a comfortable living, but not a excessive living. So I think some of that's going on.
Does it mean that the rest, out of 73%, I mean, those figures are not firm. In the United States, that means that we have less of students, American students in our universities because there are so many people from Asia. There is nothing of racial nature. It is just statistics. Patrick here.
Well, for whatever reason, and I remember the good old days with you and John in the middle of the night discussing the American education system, but unfortunately, historically, the great, brilliant people who won Nobel Prizes and patents for the United States, a lot of them were not born in the United States. Well, we have a great high-level academic system for scientists. It draws the best and the brightest, and usually industry and research in universities holds on to a significant number of them. And so even though the names sound foreign when they pick up their Nobel Prize, they're listed as Americans because they've lived here most of their lives. So we've sort of bought brains since the revolution, and we'll continue to buy brains because we're able to, and it works out that way. And I don't know if it's a calamity that Native Americans are not quite given to physics brilliance. I mean, there are some, but there are others who are not born here. That's just the way things have pretty much always been. I mean, you can go down the list of Germans and other Europeans and Asians and all manner of people who moved here in college and stayed here for the rest of their lives.
Okay, so we have a 330 million people population, and if we take 10% of educated in the United States Chinese from that number, it would be a huge amount of people we have to buy. of the brains. Enter Ishian.
Well, you don't have to buy them all. You just have to buy the best and the brightest. And again, because you've attracted them already with some of the best educational facilities known to mankind. I mean, a lot of facilities are not the best and the brightest. You know, there are A-level, B-level, D, F, G, H. But if you want to go to a great school for science and or engineering, there's a lot of them in the United States. There's a few elsewhere, but there's a big draw here. So, like I said before, it's been working for the last few hundred years. It's not that we've powered the engines of discovery with people born and bred here. I give you good old Tesla himself. Nicole was not born in the United States.
Great example, thank you for that. However, in 1999 we created NAFTA that was supposed to be just for three countries, including Mexico, and there was window of opportunity that opened up in Asia. In the 80s, Asia was in the Middle Ages. In the 90s, Asia was still far behind Russia. And now, Asia is the second economy in the world, and soon probably becoming the first one. There are more engineers than we have, and if you say that quantity is not quality, but the quality is rich here, we may just simply say how many of them, at 72 or 73% of all students of Asian origin, are there. That means, how do we stand technologically, technically, and scientifically as a competitors of Asian professionals? And to actually...
Time will tell, Wesley. Like I said before, they may jump ahead of us. They may not. I remember very similar conversations back in the 80s. People were very concerned over the Japanese. There were a lot of books on the subject. There were a lot of commentaries. There were a lot of people saying that we didn't actually win World War II. The Japanese did, but it took them, 40 more years to get their act together with it. And they were buying up massive amounts of American property and American businesses, and it looked like the brave new world was going to be talking Japanese. And then their economic bubble burst, and they had to sell all that stuff off at a loss. And no one's worried about the Japanese these days. They're all worried about the Chinese. And the Chinese have their own economic bubbles. If you have nothing better to do, take a look at the real estate market in China. There are lots and lots of empty, crumbling apartment houses that are just built as tokens to trade up and invest in and make profits, that are not viable properties. They weren't built to last. In about 20 years, they'll come crumbling down, and they've never been occupied. So there are things going on in China that might blow up in their faces, and only time will tell.
I have a problem with your response. We have 126.265 million of Japanese, and we have 230 million of Americans, but we're dealing with 2.5 billion of Chinese. Not all of them are in China. And to Asia.
Hold, please.
Yes, I agree. It's time for Paul in the Space Report, but I'll just finish up by telling you that, again, they have a lot of numbers. Numbers doesn't really count completely. Most Chinese are in poverty. They play games with their poverty levels of that, I think, something like making $1.20 a day is if you make more than that, you're not poor. That's poor even in China. So I want to thank you, Wesley, for this conversation, but I think we got to go to Paul and the SpaceNet report.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation.
As do I. Paul, bring it on with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the tonight's TechNet. And, a lot of great topics, you know, tonight. But I don't know about this last topic. All I know is our country is the one that came up with the vaccines, and we've got more people vaccinated here percentage-wise than most places around the world, that's for sure. Anyway, the Weimar Club is going to be at Cradle of Aviation on May 20th. So that would be this week on a Thursday from 10 a.m. to 4. They go every year, and because of our immunizations, apparently, I guess they're allowed back in the Cradle of Aviation. They have a call sign over there, K2CAM. They get on the different bands, you know, for this yearly event. But they didn't make it last year because of COVID. And this is, you know, for Lindbergh. And, you know, although Lindbergh sounds ancient, you know, for us, you know, he was still around when, you know, for many years. In fact, before Apollo 8 went up to the moon to orbit the moon 10 times and then come back, you know, that's what they did. And that was a big move by our country. Lindbergh actually went there and, you know, right before they left and talked to the astronauts, Borman, Lowell, and Anders before they went. You know, in reality, he's not that many years away, if you think about it. I'm sure it's over 100 when he did it, but he lived there. I think he was like in his late 60s when he showed up to Cape Kennedy at the time. Let me drop it. Okay, I always talk about the Starship that SpaceX is always building. They're always testing. Over the last 5 months, they've launched 4 starships from Boca Chica, Texas, and those 4 successfully went up around 6 miles, came back down. The idea was to land vertically back in a pad right next to where they took off from, and they were blowing up one right after the other. One actually had made it, but then it had a fire below it, and eventually it tilted over because the legs were kind of crumpled. And that one blew up too. But then the one designated SN-15 successfully made it to six miles up, tilted over, used its flaps to guide itself back to the landing pad. It went vertical. I noticed it went vertical a little higher than the other ones. So I think he might have had more fuel on that rocket. Anyway, I think that was one of the improvements. And sure enough, it came back down and landed perfectly. In fact, they are thinking about launching that one again, just to show that they have reusability. You know, they know it will be, and it's being designed for that. But I think they plan on launching that again. But we'll have to see. I don't think they're going to make a one ornament out of it. But since they're doing so good, they are putting in a request to the government. To the FCC is one group that. They are requesting permission to launch from Boca Chica, Texas, on an orbital flight, and they want to fly around the Earth almost one time. They want to fly around until they get to around Hawaii, and then actually, you know, come down vertically and land in the ocean. They just want to prove that they could get the Starship to orbit. But it's not like a lot of writers were talking about, they may might take the Starship itself, and right now it's got 3 engines. Eventually it's going to have 6 engines and have this thing launched to orbit by itself. No, they're not going to do that. They actually want to put the booster together. The Starship is 167 feet tall, but the booster is 20-some-odd feet tall. And it's the same diameter, 30 feet in diameter, all made out of stainless steel. And they're in the process of building the booster now, a couple of boosters. And the one that they would like to send into orbit, they call it BN-3, it's the booster number 3. They plan on taking the Starship, one of the Starships that aren't built yet, and put it on top of the booster. Now you have this 30-foot diameter, 400-foot tall rocket sitting in Texas. That's taller than the Saturn V rocket. Saturn V, I think, was 383 feet tall. So it's taller. And it's going to have a lot more engines, although the engine situation is a little bit on Saturn V. You had 5 big engines. That's why they called it Saturn V. And they were F1 engines, and each one produced half pounds of thrust. These engines push around 500 pounds of thrust. But the difference is, instead of having 5 engines on a booster, they're going to have 28 engines. So they have the approval to light this thing off, this 400-foot rocket, instead of the 7.5 million pounds of thrust that Saturn V got to launch all their Saturn V's. This is going to have 16,000 pounds of thrust, so over twice the amount of power launching out of Texas. So they put this request in, and here's what they want to do. They want to launch the whole setup, booster and Starship on top of it. And they plan to get up to height, almost 60 miles high. The booster and the Starship will separate. Essentially, it's the first stage and second stage. They plan on bringing the booster back. Normally, in operation, the idea will be to bring it all the way back to land, or maybe back to an oil rig that he's actually building to launch and land these things. But for now, the goal is to eventually land in Texas. But it's the first one, so rather than take any chances, he plans on landing it offshore. When I talk about Boca Chica, Texas, it's a Mexico-U.S. border. It's Brownsville, Texas. 20 miles off of Brownsville, this thing is going to come down vertically as slow as it can, and then, of course, hit the water, and just they plan on letting it go down the drain. Meanwhile, the Starship itself, the 167-foot thing with 6 engines on it, three of the engines are for, when they're in the atmosphere. And then he's got 3 vacuum engines, and they're all the same Raptor 500,000-pound thrust engines. So he's got 6 on board the second stage, or the Starship itself. And the goal of the Starship is eventually to come through the atmosphere with the heat shield and then duplicate what they've been doing, going up 6 miles high, except they'll be coming down, from orbit, and eventually land vertically. And someday they, not only will they launch satellites and cargo, but eventually people, and they'll be coming down on this Starship. So anyways, first orbital test, they'll launch it. The first stage will land in the water near Brownsville, Texas. The second stage will continue in orbit for, another hour. It takes 90 minutes to go around, so it'll be roughly that long. And then it'll turn in the opposite direction, fire its engine, slow itself down, and then come back down through the atmosphere with the heat shield. Hopefully that will survive, and then eventually come down to, I think, maybe 10, 20 miles off the coast of Hawaii. And it'll come down, and probably have boats out there, that probably have pictures of this thing, coming slowly down as if it was going to land on land, but it's going to hit the water and just disappear. And that'll be the first flight. They plan on doing this as early as July. My guess is going to be a couple of months after that. But That's Elon Musk's plan for the first orbital Starship flight. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, you guys are talking about China, their mission to Mars. They launched at the same time that three other countries launched. We launched our Perseverance rover to Mars June 30th, and then July 30th or so. Anyway, the end of July, and then the other country that launched an orbital spacecraft was the United Arab Emirates. They launched something called HOPE. It's an orbital spacecraft to go to Mars, and they paid Japan to launch it on their H2A rocket out of Japan, and successfully got there right around the same time. At the end of July was that launch, and then the other country, of course, was China. They launched on their heavy rocket, the Long March 5B rocket, the same one that was just in the news that had this core stage, coming down, willy-nilly somewhere over the Earth, and eventually wound up in the Indian Ocean. That big rocket launched the it was an orbital slash lander slash rover mission. The spacecraft is called Tianwen-1. Tianwen was the name of this whole spacecraft that went into orbit. And eventually, 3 months later, they all got there around the same time. For instance, Perseverance landed. It didn't go into orbit. It went direct into the atmosphere. It landed on February 18th. And the United Arab Emirates HOPE satellite went into orbit right around the same time. So did China. China successfully got they put on a breaking jets, and sure enough, they succeeded. But they stayed in orbit around 3 months, taking pictures down below, trying to figure out exactly where they wanted to land. They don't have the information that we have. First time they ever sent something to orbit around Mars. We've had many, many missions go there. We've got rovers all over the place. And so we have a good layout of where we want to go before we even launch. So they figured out where they wanted to go, and it was called the Utopia Plantia, which is actually the same location where one of our Viking rockets, Viking landers landed. We sent Viking up, launched in 1976 to Viking missions, Viking 1 and Viking 2. One landed on one side of the planet, and Viking 2 landed on this side, where the Utopia Plateau, which is where China landed. So they're not too far away from Viking 2. So they planned on doing this. It took 3 months. They figured out where they were going to go, and sure enough, they started the procedure. When we land a big rover like we have, is a 2-ton rover, we go indirect. We don't go into orbit. We just go indirect. What they did is now they're in orbit. Their idea is now from orbit they have to slow down. So you have the main vehicle, the Tianwen vehicle, slows itself down with the lander on board. Now normally that would deorbit the whole thing, but the idea is to keep that orbiter in orbit. They're going to use Tianwen-1 as a relay, a repeater system for the rover and the lander once it gets there. So, but the whole setup slows down. They separate the lander from Tianwen 1. Tianwen 1 starts slowing down even further because it starts picking up atmospheric drag and eventually starts going through the atmosphere where the orbiter, Tianwen 1, what they do is they reignite that engine again to accelerate to keep themselves in orbit. So it's an interesting way of doing it. We only did something that's like that similar. It looks like they copied a lot of our ideas. And we did that with the Galileo spacecraft that went to Jupiter. Back in the 90s, we sent Galileo and went to Jupiter and went into orbit, and then we needed a probe to go into the atmosphere of Jupiter. So they actually slowed the whole setup down. The probe separated and then went through the atmosphere and retransmitted back to Galileo and then back to Earth for 70 minutes. But at the same time, Galileo also speeded up and continued on into orbit around Jupiter. So China, I think, took that idea for this Mars mission. Anyway, they call it the Jiarong rover. Landed in Mars, on Mars. And they have this... When they came down through the atmosphere, they had a heat shield separated, and then they had a parachute. Eventually the whole parachute and the back shell separates, leaving the spacecraft with four legs sticking down and the rover sitting on top. And the spacecraft had an engine on the bottom. That engine ignited, slowed itself down to a couple miles an hour, and they were able to land successfully on the planet. Now, here's this thing. It looks like it's sitting pretty high up off the surface, and you have this rover sitting on top. So the next step, I haven't heard that they've done this yet. I guess they're going to wait a while. These ramps are going to unfold, allow the rover to roll down the ramps and then onto the planet. We'll see how this goes in the weeks to come. Again, I haven't seen any pictures. I thought maybe they'd have a picture of the surroundings where they're located, from the lander. But I haven't seen one picture yet, which makes me a little concerned. Russia did land a vehicle one time, and it really never sent any pictures back, no telemetry. So they never got credit for landing it. They know it landed, but it was considered a failure. So until I see a picture, I'm not going to say that this is a success, but I'm sure it probably is. Any questions or comments? WS2M. Okay, I thought maybe Frank was going to key up on EchoLink. So we'll see how this whole setup does. It's a solar-powered rover. It looks like it's a little, probably the same size, a little smaller than Spirit and Opportunity. Don't forget, we had two big rovers riding around on the planet, two solar-powered rovers for years, Spirit and Opportunity. Very successful. Spirit lasted around 6 years, and Opportunity around 14. They were supposed to last 3 months. And the warranty on this rover that China sent to Mars is also around 3 months, but let's see if they get many years out of it. Who knows? Jiarong is the rover. And we'll see how they do. And they have all kinds of instruments on board. They can see below the surface. They can tell whether or not there's water below the surface. I'm assuming they have a robotic arm, although I haven't seen a picture of it yet. Spirit and Opportunity had robotic arms, and they did plenty of geology work over the years. Our landing system, of course, is a lot different, or a real big difference. It was relatively heavy, heavier than what China sent. And their plan was to, what we did was have these gigantic airbags that, you know, puff up around it. So it was like one big sphere and it would bounce. They bounced for like, you know, a mile, bouncing on the surface of Mars. Eventually they came to a stop. Airbags automatically open up. And these big pedals, these giant pedals that motorized, pushed everything out of the way, exposing the rover on top. And the rover wasn't too high, but they still had a ramp that was deployed from the Spirit and Opportunity. That's how we got off the rover. This one, having a jet engine or a rocket engine underneath, they needed a little room. So this thing looks like it's sitting pretty high off the surface. So we'll see if they get this thing successfully onto the surface of Mars in the coming days. So that's the story on that. Any questions or comments before we can continue on? This is WS2N. Okay, back a little closer to home. Talk about the International Space Station for a second. The Axiom Company, AXIOM, their goal is to build brand new modules to attach to the front end of the International Space Station. They'd like to have one big module first and eventually two more after that, where they could send up private citizens to this module. And of course, you know, be able to fly through the insides of the International Space Station, but they want to actually attach one or two modules to the space station. But since they don't have that ready, they are sending a crew up of four people on the they call it Axiom One. And they plan, and they're all private citizens, and they plan on docking with the International Space Station and spending about 10 days on the space station before undocking and coming back. So I thought that was pretty amazing. They got this one guy that's going to be the pilot of this thing, Mike Lopez, Algeria. Mike Lopez of Algeria was an astronaut. He must have did about six flights on, into space. And I think he did at least 10 spacewalks. So he's very well, experienced astronaut. But then eventually he got away from NASA and he wound up vice president of this company, Axiom. And it turns out he's going to fly this spacecraft up to the International Space Station with these three other paying people. I get, so to me it's a joyride to the ISS. But this is the way things are getting now. So AX-1 mission, they call it. We'll see how this goes. They plan on doing this early next year. The guy that's flying it really knows what he's doing. I mean, one of his missions that he went on, he tested out the SAFER jetpack for NASA. SAFER jetpack is this piece of equipment that attaches to the back of the of all the astronauts when they do an EVA. In case they get detached from the space station in any way, they have the SAFER thing that can control it themselves. Okay, I timed that one out. Anyway, this guy, he tested out the SAFER mechanism that attaches to the back of all EVA spacesuits. And he flew like 50 feet away from the shuttle at the time. And I thought that was pretty amazing. I mean, they did other tests with this thing, but he was the guy that actually flew away with it. and they're able to automatically bring themselves back to where they left. And also there's a button that, in case they're spinning, they wind up out of control, like the movie Gravity, if you ever saw that. By the way, in the movie Gravity, for some reason, they didn't have the safety unit. But, you know, the guy would, you push the, pushes one button, and that would automatically stop you from tumbling. And then, you know, from there, you would work your way back to the space station. Fortunately, nobody's ever had to use this, which is really good. And I see that the Russians don't have it attached to their spacesuits. So when they do the EVAs, I don't know what they're thinking. I guess they just hang on, you know. I don't know that they are all tethered, and you know, there's always two tethers. So when they disconnect one, the other one is always attached. Let me drop it. Comment. Oh, okay, good. Comment, go ahead.
Two questions. This is AC2PO in Pelham, New York. I just wondered about, number one, the tethers. What is the strength under those conditions, temperature, pressure, et cetera? And number two, there was a recent paper by some professor at Weill Medical down here in New York, the Cornell professor, I guess his name is Chris Mason. He states that he suspects that there's bacteria that we sent up to Mars. If you could comment on both of those things, thanks. AC2PL.
Oh, okay. AC2PL, WS2N. The strength of the tether, well, you know, it's an eighth of an inch, a little bit bigger than that, probably 5/16 of an inch thick. And it reels out, so, you know. Let's say you had a 3/8 threaded rod, you had that into concrete, you could probably hang 15,000 pounds from that. So, you know, it's probably thousands, multiple thousand pounds of force you could probably exert on this tether. And they're not short, they're on a reel, and there's two of them. And you attach it, like, you know, when they want to go all the way out to, you know, hundreds of feet in one direction, they'll attach one and they'll reel all the way out. I think 80 feet, I think, is on a reel. So, you know, there's no problem. And there's the short tether that they always keep to that, you know, keep themselves close to the, close to all the rails. And, you know, look, if they do an EVA, there's these gold rails, and they literally walk with their hands. You know, when they call it a space walk, it's, they don't use their feet at all, you know, to go from one end to the other. I mean, they'll use their feet. They'll put it into a foot restraint. And it usually attaches to the Canadarm arm, too, the rope, you know, this 57-foot arm. And, you know, I mean, that's a little different than they really are using their feet to hold themselves in place to do work. As far as bacteria going to Mars, well, I know they all equipment. Maybe the China mission. You're saying China sent something on purpose. I don't know. I don't know about that. That doesn't sound right. But they always worry about sending something to Mars by accident. All our missions. All our landers in the past, you know, I mean, even 1997 with the Pathfinder Sojourner mission, a small rover about the size of a microwave that brought around, you know, they would spend countless hours bringing all the equipment up to temperature. You know, I think they have to hit a certain temperature, 180 degrees or something, to qualify. And then everything that goes on, lands on a planet, that's what they do. You know, if it didn't have plans of landing somewhere like Cassini, that was going around orbit for 17 years, about 14, 15 years around Saturn. You know, you would worry about the thing landing on a moon or something like that. But they had plans, even when it was designed, that it was going to be burnt up in the atmosphere of Saturn. So, if they thought it would actually hit a moon, they would have went through contamination. So with those spacecraft, they didn't. But anything that goes to Mars or, you know, anything that's going to land anywhere, you know, we actually, the European Space Agency landed our space probe on Titan around Saturn. You know, these things go through all kinds of testing. What did you hear about some kind of bacteria or germs going to Mars? Back to you. I didn't get your name. AC2PLWS2M.
WS2N and AC2PL. The name is Jeff. The location is Pelham, Westchester County. It's a little blurb that was published by a professor at Weill Medical at Cornell. You can ask Roy, he'll tell you it's a respectable place. But people like this that are seeking, in my opinion, and I should state that categorically, it is my opinion that this guy is seeking attention by stating on the front page of, or at least Yahoo's picked it up on the front page, so everyone on the planet is seeing this, that we're sending bacteria out into space and populating Mars with it, unintentionally, of course. It's really just the sort of thing that I think the space agencies have to get in front of and make very definitive statements that they've taken all the appropriate steps. And I know what sort of steps they take because I've read about it, and you know what sort of steps they take, but obviously anyone who looks at the front page of Yahoo and sees this sort of nonsensical statement by someone with serious credentials is going to think otherwise. Good.
Okay, Jeff, very good. Yeah, you know, like the Inquirer years ago had this weird looking picture of a bug that said, you know, life found on Mars. I cut it out. That's always really funny. But I could see somebody that doesn't pay that much attention to the protocols that these people go through to sterilize this stuff and then work on the equipment. You know, all they have to do is bring up videos of, you know, you go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA.gov or something, and you look at the Perseverance rover, or the last one, the Curiosity rover, being built, in fast time. You know, you see these people, you know, it's time-lapse photography. Then you see these people with masks and hats, and, you know, I mean, it's an operating room. I'm sure there's no difference between what they do. And Roy could tell you, you know, a real operating room. I mean, they really go overboard. All kinds of doors you have to go through. Pressure, there's higher pressure inside the room where these spacecraft are in case, you know, there's an air leak somewhere. In the wall, you know, no air can get into this room. So they really do a good job of doing this. Takes like forever if you're going to work in there. Takes, you know, it's a forever thing just to get into the room before you start work. So, and if you're talking about Cornell, I talk about the Cornell in Ithaca, upstate New York, where Carl Sagan used to teach astronomy, or the other Cornell. Back to you.
No, it was from Weill Medical. So, unfortunately, well, either one of them has the appropriate credentials to make a statement that people listen to. But in individual professors, I mean, come on, we know that self-aggrandizement is something that always sells. So, I know that there are BSL 1, 2, 3 level sort of treatments for making sure that nothing gets in, nothing comes out, and whether we pressurize things positive or negative depending on which direction. We have samples that we don't want our human bacteria to populate, so we make the pressure positive in there, and then of course you if you never want something which is terrific human pathogen to get out, you make the positive, the pressure negative in there. Again, Roy will address all this when he gets back on. But the point being that